Amen. Great to see you guys today, and glad you negotiated the time changes. And I don't know if you think you're here for third service or not, but welcome anyway. Well, we've been going through the book of 1 Samuel, and I've really enjoyed this study. We went through Samuel's story, and for the most part, Saul's story, and then the early years of and middle years of David's story. But we're coming to a conclusion. Next week, Lord willing, we'll finish the book. And before we go on to 2 Samuel, I'm going to take a break from this, and I'm going to go through the Gospel of Matthew. I just like to get back to Jesus every once in a while, and so we remember what we're here for. And then, Lord willing, after that, we'll do 2 Samuel as well. But the story of David up to this point has been pretty miserable. We saw it last week, where David's history was a history of being rejected over and over again, rejected by his own family, rejected by his king, rejected by his father-in-law, who was the king, rejected by his wife, rejected by people everywhere he went, until he finally found a home with the Philistines. And he thought he belonged, but as we saw in chapter 29 last week, ultimately they lined up all the soldiers to go to war, and the other Philistine rulers said, "What are those Jews doing here? We don't want Jews in our army." And now he is rejected because of his heritage, even though his heritage didn't want him at all. He was so dejected. He argued. He tried to change it, but nope, you guys need to go back home. And so it felt like he had hit rock bottom. He walked for 3 days with his 600 guys to go back to this little city of Ziklag where their families were. And if you thought he had hit bottom, he hadn't, because now in chapter 30, he hits rock bottom. It was bad being rejected, rejected, rejected. In chapter 30, it's worse. So let's dive into this story. Now it happened, verse 1, 1 Samuel chapter 30. When David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, walked for 3 days, it was quiet, nobody's saying anything. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. But the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacking Ziklag and burned it with fire. The Amalekites, who Saul was supposed to destroy them, they keep bouncing back because he spared certain of them and some of their animals and everything. They were still able to come. And, they hated Israel because of, what had been done to them. But at the same time, the survivors were doing as much damage as they could possibly do. And they knew the Philistines were heading up north to attack Israel, and they took advantage of it, and they were just rampaging the whole area, and including Ziklag. And so David's hometown, where there was no one left there to protect it, his 600 soldiers were with him. It's basically just the women and children were left, and they burned the city, and in verse 2, had taken captive the women and those who were there, from small to great. They did not kill anyone, which is surprising the way they had been treated, but carried them away and went their way. So the Amalekites took all their stuff and all their people and left. So when David and his men came to the city, there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, and their daughters had been taken captive, as well as all their stuff. And verse 4, this is where David hits bottom. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. That's it. There's nothing left. There's nothing more. Everything that we've tried has backfired on us. We're off trying to build a future, and these guys come in and they take everything and they destroy our hometown. We thought, well, at least we can go home and recover. They were so devastated that all they could do is cry. Crying's a really healthy thing sometimes. It can get excessive, but You know, sometimes the right response to devastation is crying. It does something for us. Children are built to be able to cry naturally. You don't have to teach them to do it. And it has a certain cathartic effect to it when you cry. In our culture, we've always told men they shouldn't cry. And then now we tell women they shouldn't cry either. And so we're denying our humanity in a whole lot of ways. Sometimes it's just a time to cry. Sometimes crying is the most natural and appropriate and even healing response to devastation. And so they just cried themselves out until they couldn't cry anymore. David's two wives, verse 5, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Now David was greatly distressed. He was incredibly under pressure at this point, not only because he had lost his family, but the people were speaking of stoning David because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. So David cried until he couldn't cry anymore, and then he realizes, oh shoot, these people are blaming me. By the way, if you're a leader, you'll usually get blamed for whatever happens. And the people who are following you are just saying, well, if you had only done this or if you had done that, either if you did something or if you hadn't done what you did, basically it comes down on you. And so he's lost everything just like they have. Never mind that he has risked his neck to protect them time and time again. Now it's like I'm all cried out and now they're talking about stoning me. It doesn't get lower than that. This is David hitting rock bottom. But look what it says he did. But, in the end of verse 6, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I don't know what that means, okay? It means something. It certainly means that where he hadn't in a long time, you don't see records of him seeking the Lord or wanting to hear what God has to say. When he hit bottom, he knew, I need God in a big way. I need to turn back to him. But it's interesting, the choice of words, that he strengthened himself in the Lord. Now, previously, Jonathan had come to him and he said, Jonathan, strengthen David's hand in the Lord. So sometimes another person can come along and lift you up. But what I see from this verse is sometimes there's nobody to do that. Sometimes it's just you. Everyone has turned against you or they don't want to be too close to you. And maybe you've been like that in your life at some point where it's like all the people that I thought would have my back don't. What I'm suffering alone. Nobody understands. No one can help me. Nobody even seems to want to help me. And most people are blaming me for the situation that I'm in. It's in times like that that you have to figure out a way to become strong in the Lord without having the support of other people. Now, God would always want us, ideally, to support each other and to strengthen each other in the Lord. But I would suggest to you that the times when you need the greatest strength from the Lord are going to be times when there isn't anyone else there to do it with you. There are times when after you've cried and you've grieved and you're under attack and you're feeling isolated, that you have to tell yourself, suck it up. You're going to have to deal with this. God is God. God is real. He has been there for you in the past. But you better remind yourself of this because nobody else is really doing it. It's just you right now. And at the times when we feel the most devastated are those times when we feel like nobody really gets it. No one can, well, they might try to say things to help me feel better. But the truth is, if I can't do it myself with the Lord, if I can't find a way where just as a human that it's just me and God, and I am going to make this happen because I absolutely need it, that's kind of where David was at that point. Again, I wish it gave us more details about how he strengthened himself in the Lord, but he gave himself a pep talk. He reminded himself of who God is. And then we're going to see, ultimately, he turned to prayer as well. But it was just him, and he took responsibility for the way that he would deal with this because he didn't have anyone else. And so he strengthened his hand in the Lord and strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. And then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son. Remember, this priest signed up with David when his whole family got killed by Saul because of David. And so now he's hanging with David. He had managed to steal the ephod, the high priest's chest garment that had the Urim and the Thummim in it, which we don't really know how the Urim and Thummim worked, but somehow God would use it in order to talk to people at certain times. So he called him and said, "Bring the ephod here to me." And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?" And God answered. He strengthened himself in the Lord, and then he pulled it together enough to cry out to God in prayer. And God answered. He goes, "What shall I do now?" David's come a long ways. When he was earlier, when he was younger, remember when his guys and he got disrespected by Nabal, they just took off. "We're going to go kill that guy and everybody in his household." And Abigail talked him out of it. Now I'm not going to make a move until I've asked God, and I want to hear from him. It's been a long time since David's done that. And if it's been a long time for you before you really go to God and just ask him what you should do, he's always there waiting. But you're going to have to pull it together enough to do that and be willing to do what he tells you to do. He's not going to give you a multiple choice answer. So he goes, "Shall I pursue him or not?" And God answered, "Pursue." Yeah, chase these guys. "For you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all." Not only will you catch them and defeat them, you'll get everything back. That let him know, my wives, my kids, they're still alive. Here's a chance for us to recover what has been taken from us, and God's telling me to do this. And so by him crying out to God, that was a good thing. So he went, 600 guys with him. Right away, God told him, and he goes, "Okay, you tell me to do it, I'm doing it now. We are going now." They got to the brook Bezor, and David continued on with 400 men, according to verse 10. For 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Bezor. They'll come into the story later. But you have only 600 soldiers. 200 of them are like, "I just don't think I can get across this stream. I'm completely out of energy and strength and capacities. We just can't do it." Now, David didn't lecture them. He didn't like, "Come on, you're going to do it anyway. Beat them, make them come." At the same time, he didn't hold everyone back. It's like, "We have a mission that we're going to go on. You guys can stay here and watch all of our extra stuff. We'll leave supplies with you, and you can stay here." And so they continued. And then they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, verse 11. This guy was just laying there dying. And so they gave him bread and he ate. They let him drink water, gave him some fig Newtons and some ivermectin, two clusters of raisins, which he was really mad because he thought they were chocolate chips and he ate them and they were raisins. But so when he had eaten, his strength came back to him. For he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. He's been laying there dying. They find him. It's amazing that David took the time to minister this guy back to health. Now, it turned out this guy had some information that helped David find where these guys had gone who had captured his family. But he could have just splashed some water in his face and shaken him and said, "Here's a spear at your throat. Tell me what I need to know." But he actually cared enough to nurture the guy back to enough health and strength and care about him, even though he was an Egyptian. And so he does it, and then he said, "Who are you? Who do you work for?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite." So I was working for the Amalekites as a slave, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick. What a difference. David had a third of his army that couldn't continue, and he left them there with food and supplies. It's cool. You guys wait here. Watch the stuff. The Amalekites have a guy who's been faithful, but he's sick. Just leave him without any food or water. But he says, "We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites in the territory which belongs to Judah and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." He's like, "I was a part of it. You should probably know that. I was one of the ones who actually, you know, trashed your city, burned it, and helped kidnap your families." And David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" Now, I don't know how he would know exactly where the troop was because he had been laying there 3 days. But he would have some sort of clue as to maybe how to help them find him. And the guy goes, "Hey, promise me that you're not going to turn me over to my master because he'll kill me. Promise me that you won't kill me." And he goes, "Sure." And so in verse 16, when he brought him down, there they were, the Amalekites, spread out over all the land, eating and drinking, dancing and partying because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. These guys were, they thought they had it all. They had pulled it off. They got so much stuff that they just began to celebrate and get drunk and dance and have a party. And by the way, I don't care what you've done that's successful, getting out of control with your partying is a good way to set yourself up, which is exactly what it did for them. So what David did, you know, he saw them partying, so he waited until twilight, and David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. This is kind of weird. They had 400 camels, so 400 guys got the 400 camels and took off. I mean, if they were fast enough to get to the camels, they were probably 400 of the better soldiers. Now, the Amalekites still haven't been destroyed. Saul was supposed to destroy them. He didn't. This wouldn't destroy them because 400 of them got away. You'll see Amalekites keep coming up and being an enemy of Israel for quite a while. In fact, it's an Amalekite that takes credit for killing Saul ultimately. So 400 get away, they wipe out all the rest. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. Now, they didn't just take it from Ziklag, they took it from all kinds of places. So they got everything. David rescued his two wives, and they were blaming each other. And nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all, just like God had promised him that he would. He got everything back. And then David took all the flocks and herds, everything that these guys had driven before them, all their livestock, and he said, "I'll take these. This is David's spoil." Now, as they're marching back, celebrating, they're so happy, all their families are there. The 200 guys waiting back at the river, like they were waiting to see their families, and they were hoping this worked out. And so they came, they were so weary they couldn't follow David, but they stayed at the brook Bezor. They went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. "Hey guys, we're back." And then in verse 22, there were some just really creeps that worked for David as soldiers. All the wicked and worthless men. Just because somebody's strong enough to go fight doesn't make them worthwhile. Some of them weren't. Of those who went with David, answered and said, "Because they did not go with us, because they wimped out at the brook, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Let's just give these guys their wives and kids and tell them to go on their way. We don't have need for them anymore." But David said, "My brethren, You shall not do so with what the Lord has given us. He goes, no, we're not going to discriminate like that because everything we have came from God. So somebody who's back here watching the stuff is just as much a recipient of God's generosity as those of us whose job was to fight, because it wasn't our brilliant strategy, our brilliant fighting. If God hadn't let us meet that Egyptian and then given us the power and we got up early and we went for it, it was all God's. So we're not going to act like it's ours to dole out. He has preserved us, delivered into our hands the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? You guys are off. But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike. They deserve to be rewarded. We're staying back and working behind the scenes, the same as the frontline soldiers. And so it was in verse 25. From that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day, to the day that this was written, that the law is, when we go out to war, whatever we take, you know, as a reward for winning the warfare, then the people that are back guarding the stuff, the people who aren't able to go out and fight, they're going to receive just as much as the ones who are fighting on the front lines. And they made that a law. Now, last part of the chapter, when David, in verse 26, came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And it lists all the different cities of Judah where he said, we're not just going to hang on to all this stuff. We have a lot of stuff. Let's be generous with what God has given us. Because not only does God want to bless us with the spoil, but there are these other villages, these other cities that have been trashed by the Amalekites as well. Let's send them a bunch of stuff too. And so he very generously shared with them, which is a pretty honorable thing to do. And it says that he sent stuff in Hebron and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to rove. Now, there were a couple of good things about this. For one thing, he's not greedy. So whenever you have a windfall, you can decide, am I going to spend more on me, or does this make it possible for me to help others? And the ironic thing is, helping others actually is the best thing you can do for you. Sitting on your winnings is never a healthy thing. It's never something that will ultimately give you what you want. But not only that, by him sharing with these other cities of Judah, after chapter 31, when the Philistines conquer and defeat Saul, now the nation's trying to put itself back together. David has been anointed as king. But guess who accepts him as king first? The tribes of Judah. Because he blessed them. They saw the good that he was doing while Saul was off fighting against Philistines. But also, David was from the tribe of Judah. He realized, hey, you're my people. And so that's kind of where he started his power base as he ultimately took over as the king of all of Israel. So him being generous was not just something that was totally against his self-interest. Being generous and sharing is always in the self-interest of the person who is generous. Being greedy and hoarding what you have is always against the self-interest of anyone, which, you know, Jesus over and over again talked about that, you know, and he talked about the rich guy that just kept building bigger garages for all of his stuff. And he goes, your soul's required of you. Now what? What's that going to do for you? And so David seemed to understand this. Now, this is a great story. I mean, the story of David is really ending until we get into 2 Samuel. Next chapter, it'll really pretty much be about Saul and Jonathan and what happens to them as the kingdom ultimately at this point fell to the Philistines. But the things that I want to accentuate for you in this chapter are things that I think we all need to remember. First of all, sometimes you just need to cry. Don't resist the urge when you feel overwhelmed to cry. Crying is very cathartic. It's a natural thing to do. It's unnatural to constantly hold back what you're feeling. It's just not good for you. And so if David and his men, when they hit bottom, they just cried for a while, that's something that we can certainly learn from as well. But after he was crying a while and the people were crying, the next thing that David does, he gets distressed because people are turning on him. And so he chose, you know, all these people are bugged. David decided, I'm going to strengthen myself in the Lord his God. He didn't have anybody else to strengthen himself in. But he took responsibility to say, I'm in this situation. This is the way it's going. And I don't have anybody else. So God, I need you. And I need you help me strengthen me. And as much as it's okay to cry and be overwhelmed, it's equally okay to, after you've cried yourself out, to go tell yourself, suck it up. Now, you're going to have to do this. This is real. You know who God is. And again, I don't know exactly what he did when he strengthened himself in the Lord. It involved God, but it involved something he did to himself. He took responsibility for his own spiritual condition in a connection with God. And there are times when we have to do that. Like, there's nobody else right now that understands or that has credibility with me or that even is on my side. Most everybody just wants me to fail. They're looking for me to fall apart. So God, it's me and you. And I know about you. I know who you are. David has been pretty far from God. He hasn't been writing psalms and communing with God during this time. He's just been trying to survive. And maybe you've gone through those times in your life sometimes where it's like, I've just been trying to get by. I've been trying to get up every morning and get to bed and sleep while I'm tired. And in terms of communing with God, it hasn't really happened. So he took responsibility for himself. And as he did that, he then turned to prayer. And it's so important for us, whatever we're going through, to be in the place, each of us, where we go, I need to ask God what to do. And when I ask him what to do, I'm going to do it. I don't care if anybody else follows me. I don't care if I win or lose. I'm just going, God, what do I do? How long has it been, if there's an area of your life where you're struggling, when you've just said, God, what do you want me to do? I'll do it if you tell me what you want me to do. Now, I wish I had a Urim and Thummim because those were pretty effective in giving a real specific answer. I keep shopping on eBay for them, haven't found any. But at some point, we have to just go, okay, God, what do I do? And see what he leads you to do. And whatever he tells you to do, do that. Don't worry about, well, how about this other stuff? What if this happens? What if that happens? No. You go for it after you ask him what to do and you move forward. And that's what he did. But I see also a real lesson in these 200 guys who couldn't cross the brook. 200 guys who are like, sorry, I just can't move forward. It's interesting that David didn't give them a pep talk. It's interesting that he didn't tell them, you're gonna do it, or come on. I've strengthened myself in the Lord. Let me strengthen you. You need to strengthen yourself. Get going. No, they couldn't do it. And he took them at their word. And he wasn't mad at them, and he didn't guilt them. He didn't say, well, you should be doing this. What's wrong with you? When I was your age, none of that kind of stuff. It's just like, okay. And there's the lesson here for us. You can't, and I can't, tell someone what they can do. We can't take our expectations and think, well, I did that, so you should be able to do it. I'm doing it right now, so you should be able to. I did it when I was your age, you should do it. We have to accept the fact that when somebody says they can't do it, just go, okay, I'm not going to stay back because you can't do it. I'm going to still do what I need to do, but I'm not going to try to push you. Pushing you would only slow everything down. So If God's doing something, he can do it with or without you. And by the way, here's some stuff you can do in the meantime. Here are some ways that you can contribute. Here are some ways that you can help. And he honored them and then actually rewarded them. You know, I think we sometimes think that the more you do for God, the more reward you get from God. But if David is right, and every success that we have comes because of God, not from us. And as David said, the guys that couldn't go any further, they are just as important a part of what God did as the ones who moved forward and who actually fought in this war. This is really important for us to remember, because people can only do what they can do. And it really doesn't help to guilt them and manipulate them and push them and drag them and pull them. Come on, suck it up, you can do it. No, if you can say that to yourself, good, strengthen yourself. But it doesn't work with other people. And I don't know what someone else is able to do. Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist who, a Jewish psychiatrist who got put into the concentration camps under Hitler. And in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he said, everyone has a different capacity for pain. And he said, you have to understand this. He said, I was in a concentration camp and I watched my father killed, my wife killed, my children killed, and I survived. But he said, I made it through that. And he said, a 13-year-old girl whose boyfriend breaks up with her and she kills herself is in more pain than I was in. And he said, you have to understand that. Everyone's threshold of pain in every circumstance is different. So don't judge other people for what they can and can't do. Just accept this is the way it is. And don't exclude them. I mean, we see this today. Our society is so divided and everyone wants to say, well, if you're this, then you don't belong with us. No, we're all in this together. We're all in this because of God's grace. Whatever ideas you have about whatever, however you vote, whatever you think, man, we're on the same team. Maybe you're not seeing it clearly. Maybe I'm not seeing it clearly. There are some people who can, you know, and I joke about it a lot of times, but some people are like, I live in California and this is where I'm going to stay. There are other people who are like, I got to get out of California. You know what? It's okay. You're not leaving God. In fact, you can be a part of a church and go, that's my church. And then after a time, you're like, I don't know, I'm over it. It's time for me to go somewhere else. The way I look at it is, if anyone has ever been a part of our church, they are always a part of our church. Never ask anyone to leave our church. I've never told anyone, this isn't your church anymore. It's like, no, if you need to stay back, that's fine. Or maybe you think I'm staying back and you're moving forward. That's cool too. We're all in this together. And it's important to remember that we are only as strong as all of our people. Now, what happens, and those of you who are older know what this is like, there are times when you just don't have the strength that you once had. And they're like, come on, let's go do this. And you're like, I just don't know if I can right now. There was a time when I would have jumped all over that, but now, oh man, I don't know. I remember when Steve Goodman went on one of his first missions trips because his boys were doing water wells in Africa. And Steve's like a super picky eater and he likes things to be comfortable, but he sucked it up and did it. And I was so proud of him. He didn't do it again, I'm pretty sure. But it's like, okay, I had to prove it. Truth is, he's better off back here, and that's okay. For every one of us, there's a time. There's a time when I just loved traveling and things like that. Now I'm like, I get asked to go to some other country, and I'm just like, oh man, I don't know. I don't have the strength that I once had. The day will come when I'm not able to do what I'm doing as the bare essentials of what I do. That's okay. That's not like, oh no, that would be a horrible time. I remember when Pastor Chuck was, you know, he was like a little over 80, and we were at a pastor's conference, and he when he spoke, he talked about Joshua and Caleb, And Caleb, when he was 80 years old, said, "I am as strong today as I was when I was 40. And Chuck said, "That's the way I feel." And so I spoke after Chuck and I go, "You know, Chuck said that he's like Caleb," and I agree, he is like Caleb, because he's as delusional as Caleb was. Caleb was not as strong at 80 as he was at 40, but I love that Caleb thought that, and I love that Chuck thinks that. No, you aren't who you used to be, but don't push other people. Don't push the next generation to be more than they are. Take them along, be thankful for their enthusiasm, but don't let them make you feel like you're a loser because you can't keep up with them. That's the way life is. The reward of getting older is sometimes you just can't cross the brook every time. Sometimes you sit out some battles. Sometimes it's like, you know what? I've done that. I've fought those battles, but right now I'm really just trying to survive. According to what David said here, and I believe according to what God says, it's okay, man. If you're the person who's back there praying for the people who are doing this stuff, that's incredibly important. I know for me, and you'll be rewarded in the same way. That's as important of a role to play. I'm thankful for Kevin Soderfield is just a longtime friend. In fact, Kevin was the only person who told me after I came to Pastor Pacific Hills that he voted against me. I asked people to vote. There were like 6 votes, I think, against me. And Kevin told me I was one of them. And I go, "You guys are the only people that have any sense at all. You voted for me after hearing me speak a couple times, you know." But Kevin always really pushed to support me. And he would remind me constantly, "You need to get away. You need to spend time with the Lord." He said, "Anytime you just need to get away and spend time with the Lord, put on your appointment book, Kevin Soderfield. And we'll say we have an appointment, but your job during that appointment is to go down to the beach and walk on the beach and spend time with the Lord." I reminded him of that this week. I was talking to him. Kevin's been battling cancer. 24 years ago, they gave him 6 months to live. And so this week, I was talking to him and just sharp, and I was reminding him of some of those stories, and we were laughing and going back and forth with it. And I told Kevin, I go, 24 years, I don't believe you're ever going to die. I think they're faking it because they keep telling you you're going to die, and you don't. You'll probably outlive all of us. And he goes, "Well, I'm trying." And then the next day, he went to be with the Lord. And I was like, that guy never quit. I know that he was praying for me. I know that he would let me know that he disagreed with almost everything I did because that was Kevin. But I knew he loved me. And when he told me that last time, it was like, that'll be with me until I see him again. But he hasn't been able to, he's been, you know, laying in bed. He hasn't been able to come and work in the tape ministry and all that kind of stuff like he used to do, work on our computers and all that. He's just been busy surviving. But I knew he was praying for me, and he had just as much a part in what God's doing. And he reminding me that I can't do everything always. And of course, I'll greatly miss him and Gay and the boys, in case you're wondering. They're going to do a memorial service for him probably in the summer because they didn't want to do anything too soon. And he was excited to donate his body to be used for science because it was amazing how long he lived with all the conditions that he had. So I think his body was donated to USC, which they could have used him on their football team yesterday. They were terrible, but I know where he is. He's with the Lord. But was he more important when he was doing a bunch of stuff? Maybe one of the most important things he did is to remind me that I can't do everything. I appreciate that. Most people are telling you should do more and more. Oh, you ought to do this. Oh, you should come to this thing. You should speak at this fellowship. You should do it. It's really good when there's somebody who goes, "You know what, man? Stay back at the brook. You'll be fine. Everything will be okay." We all need that. We all need to know that, and we need to remember that. Because the older you get, the more you're going to find yourself hanging back. And hanging back, you're doing just as much. As you're praying for those that God is using, for the things that are happening, you're probably doing more good guarding the stuff and being supportive spiritually than you would if you're out there hacking away at Amalekites. And in this story, that's what I'm always going to remember. And then just the kindness and the generosity. The fact that David was kind to this Egyptian, and then he was kind to all these other villages. They never totally accepted him until he became king. But he was like, we had a great victory, and I want to share this as much as I possibly can. Pragmatically, that was probably a wise move, but it was a heart, too, of just going, you know what? God gave us this. This isn't mine. It's not mine to keep. It's mine to share and to pass out. And I love that this book is almost ending with that thought, the compassion and the generosity and the recognition that it's God who wins our battles. And when we find ourselves all cried out and completely devastated and under attack, as the leader, you're being judged and people want to stone you, you know what? That doesn't stop God from doing what God does. And that's something very important for us to remember. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this story and for the truth that it contains. There are times when we're the guys out on the front lines and we can't wait to go to war. There are times when we're like, I don't know if I can get across the river. I thank you that you see everyone in every situation, in every phase of their lives, as those who are worthy members of your body, of your team, of your people. And Lord, we all want to share in the rewards of what you do, and we want to share it with others as well. So thank you for the lessons that you bring us from this chapter, from these events as we're winding down this book of 1 Samuel. We're grateful. And Lord, as we celebrate communion now, help us to reflect on that commonness, that connection that we have with you by what Jesus did for us. Help us to know that as each of us receives the body and the blood, these tokens of you, that we will remember we are all in this together. It's by your stripes that we are healed. Thank you for giving us a church where we can come together and celebrate all that you've done and all that you're going to do, Lord. And we love you in Jesus' name. Amen.